Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program discussing issues of concern to the family and those who hold traditional family values in Pennsylvania and our nation. Archives of these programs can be heard at www.afafpa.org. And now, your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania.
The election of November 4th should create major change in Washington, D.C., but we have to get through the lame duck session first. That started 2 days ago and will last until right before Christmas. How dangerous can this time be? Think repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Obamacare being rammed through the Senate, and passage of the nice-sounding Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, which requires schools to serve low-calorie, unappetizing meals that many students simply throw away, were all passed during the lame duck session. But an even greater danger in the Senate can be the confirmation of radical, unqualified judges and the replacement of Eric Holter during the lame duck session. My guest today is Philip Jaregi. He's with the Washington, D.C.-based Judicial Action Group. Thanks, Philip, for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you, Diane, for having me on.
Now, let's start with what is the purpose of the Judicial Action Group?
Well, our purpose is, in two words, judicial renewal, and we define that as the returning of the judiciary to its proper role of just deciding cases rather than the problem we've had for the last few decades of the judiciary legislating from the bench. And we do that by working on legislative bills, but also primarily judicial nominations, which, of course, you know, that's where judges get on the federal bench. So it's a big deal.
Right, absolutely. Because when you look at the Constitution, the judge's role is not what we see today.
That's right. That's right. They have a very limited role. And the founders, matter of fact, called the judiciary the least dangerous branch.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen where in the last few decades, up until, I'll say, the president, Obama, took office, they were the most dangerous branch.
Yeah,
I think the executive today is the most dangerous.
Oh, yeah, that's true, with his executive orders. True. Yeah. And the combination of the two have really brought the country to a dangerous situation, to, you know, historically,
yeah.
We're looking at.
Right.
You know, we don't know what kind of damage is being done with his executive orders and the rulings that have been handed down by judicial activists. And when you're looking at the nomination of a judge or any, like even attorney general, just exactly what does the confirmation say about the nomination, the president's nomination of those individuals?
Well, with the attorney general, this has been really interesting. Honestly, I don't know what the White House has been up to, but it really looks to me like they have not had their act together, to be honest with you, because when Eric Holder announced his resignation, I guess it was about 5 weeks or so ago.
It's been a good while, yeah.
First thing that hit my mind is I thought, what is the deal with the timing?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, they're going to likely have less votes in the Senate in January, so they don't want to do a confirmation then. They don't want to have a confirmation before the election, because then you're putting a lot of vulnerable Democrats that are trying to get reelected on record with a big issue right before the election. So I thought, well, looks like they're going to try to get somebody through the lame duck session. And yet, to do that, they really needed to nominate someone before the election in order to get the calendar to work right. But I think they thought, well, we can still get somebody through. After the election, it looked like Tom Perez would be the nominee.
No, that would have been
and
very bad.
As horrible as Eric Holder is, and he is,
yeah,
Perez would be even worse.
Oh, wow.
And so we were very concerned about that and worked really hard to get the word out on Perez. And again, I don't know what happened at the White House, but they didn't go with Perez. And of course, they nominated Loretta Lynch.
Right. And in fact, I think it was on October 31st, the New York Daily News, I believe it was kind of, I think it was an aide who had, I don't know exactly who said, but they were, that article was saying that Holter's choice was Loretta Lynch of New York.
Yeah.
Although Holter kind of denied that, but.
Yeah, and that concerns me.
know,
that certainly is not a positive for Loretta Lynch.
Not quite as bad as Perez, but you know, looking at the person nominating, you're not going to get a good nominee anyway.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
And so it looks like there were some other really bad folks under consideration, but we're a long way from endorsing Lynch, because I don't think Lynch will be a great nominee and certainly would not be the type that we would want from a Republican president.
Right.
Her record's a lot thinner than some of these other folks, and so we'll see. I mean, Eric Holder knows her a whole lot better than you and I do, Diane, and the fact that he was recommending
her.
That's concerning. So
that
we'll
is
see.
That is very concerning. So she's got a thinner record, which means there's not a lot that the senators can look at as far as her past cases and stuff that she's been involved
well,
in.
Thinner, yes. We did a lot of research. There was a list that we developed of 17 names that were being sort of run around as potential nominees. And so we pulled as best as we could the records together on those folks. But that's different. The research that we're able to do is different than what we're able to do when a nominee goes before the committee. Because when a nominee goes and of course the Attorney General will be before the Judiciary Committee of the Senate, they have to submit a questionnaire with answers, and that's somewhere between 40 and as many as 80 pages long, depending on the record of the nominee.
Okay.
And so once Lynch submits that questionnaire, then we'll have that questionnaire, and we'll go through and we'll research the speeches that she's...
Is that a matter of public record?
It is. It certainly is.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you have access to it. Your listeners do.
Mm-hmm.
We do. But it has cases that she's been a part of. It has radio interviews, you know, press interviews, anything that she may have written.
Mm-hmm.
And so there will be a lot out there that we'll be able to look at.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I know she's a federal prosecutor from New York.
That's right.
The Brooklyn area? I think that's where she's in, I believe.
I believe that's right.
Yeah, she's had 2 decades of experience. And supposedly, this New York Daily Times article also says that she would carry Holder's strong legacy of civil rights, given her own background. That's what the New York Daily Times article said on October 31st. When I'm looking at Eric Holder's legacy of civil rights, I'm not sure I want that legacy to be carried on.
I agree. I mean, I think they may be assuming some things, but. I have seen some things that concern me that she would carry on some of Holder's efforts opposing voter ID.
Oh, wow.
And that's a big deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, we'll see. I want to get more on her record and see for myself what she's written and what she's done. And by the way, too, forgive me for not knowing, but she's from the Eastern District of New York. I think that's Brooklyn, but my geography's not too
straight.
Okay,
I don't know New York City area either. But I think I read that somewhere. Anyway, she's from New York City area. Let's put it like that then.
There you go.
Kind of
covered
it all.
It's the Eastern District. So
okay,
that's probably
Eastern
Brooklyn.
District. Okay, okay. I know that Senators Ted Cruz and Mike Lee want the confirmation vote to wait until after the new Senate is seated in January. And
that's
they
right.
also are wanting her to issue, wanting Loretta Lynch to issue a statement to declare whether she supports the president's use of executive action. So
on immigration in particular.
Yeah, immigration, I mean, that's a big thing. I mean, as far as immigration goes, even Harry Reid's telling the president to wait until after they have a budget deal passed during the lame duck session. But Cruz and Lee want her statement on whether she supports the president's use of the executive orders.
That's right. And the first thing you mentioned is their desire for her to go through her confirmation hearings in January rather than during the lame duck session.
Right.
And it's looking likely that that's going to be the case. There hasn't been, from what I've been able to gather yesterday and today, any announcements. But it does seem likely that this nomination will go through the committee in January rather than now. And that's a good thing.
That's absolutely a good thing. Yeah, I know that... Some Democratic aides earlier this week said the time crunch and growing GOP opposition to Lynch made it, quote, exceedingly unlikely that the replacement for Eric Holder would be confirmed in December. So that definitely is good news.
Right.
Now, let's look at the lame duck session. And,
you
know, the main purpose of the lame duck session would be to deal with major issues, such as budgetary issues. But it's become, as I listed some of the things that have happened during lame duck sessions in the intro, it has become a vehicle to allow basically people who have been unelected to pass legislation because the incoming senators and congressmen will not take their oath of office until January. So that gives the ones who lost the election the ability to continue working, public that in quotes, through the remainder of November into, well, right around Christmas time.
Right.
So, and, you know, they can look at, as we've just said, that probably the Attorney General confirmation hearings and vote will not take place until after the new Senate is seated. But I know Harry Reid said he'd like to get 50 judicial nominees through during the lame duck session.
50 or 15?
50, 5-0. I read that way back, right after the election.
Well, that's interesting because there were only 33.
Oh, really?
but I'll say this. The president nominated about five more on Wednesday.
Okay.
So there is, I cannot imagine that they could get those folks into committee hearings, voted out of committee, get them on the floor and get votes. So
I don't see how they could properly go through the steps to get that done. But that was in November.
We're fighting that issue, and I know you are too, Diane. Yeah. You joined in with our leader's letter of 28 different leaders that have written opposing all confirmations during the lame duck session.
Because that's not fair for the incoming.
Yeah, and we're having some success, but yesterday two judges were confirmed, and of course that's disappointing.
Oh, wow.
One of whom is Randolph Moss, who's probably concerned me more than anyone, and I think that's why Reid put him up first.
Wow.
But Randolph Moss was a nominee to the District of Columbia, the D.C. court, and he was an American Constitution Society member. And for your listeners, don't let that nice name fool you. They ought to be the American Anti-Constitution Society because they are activists. That's really what this organization is about. It's about judicial activism.
So he was confirmed to the D.C. Circuit Court?
Yes. Not the D.C. Circuit Court. So it's not the appellate court, but it's the D.C. District Court. Trial court in D.C., which is still a very, very one of the most powerful district courts or trial courts in the nation.
Is that the one that Obama has loaded, or is that the circuit?
That's the circuit court, but of course how it works is you have a number of D.C. district court judges that make rulings in D.C., and then those are appealed to the D.C. Circuit, and that's where the president stacked that court with three political hacks a year ago.
Absolutely. Wow. Not good news there. But like you said, Harry Reid knew that there was no way this guy was going to get through with a Republican-controlled Senate next year.
That's right. And the vote, by the way, on that was 54 to 45, and so the Republicans were able to muster 45 votes against that nominee, and so you can see, by virtue of the math, that nominee would not have been confirmed in the new Senate in January.
Right, absolutely. I can almost guarantee you know how the senators in Pennsylvania voted. Let me see. Senator Casey voted aye, and Senator Toomey voted nay.
I haven't looked,
but I'm sure that's the way it went down.
You're right. You're right. I checked it before, and the only Democrat that voted against Moss was Joe Manchin from West Virginia.
Okay, West Virginia.
Yeah, God bless him.
Absolutely.
And then the only Republican that voted for was Susan Collins. No big surprise there.
No surprise there. Out of Maine, yeah. I think Manchin needs to change the letter after his name, and so does Susan Collins.
I think so. Manchin won't be up for another few years for re-election, but I just hope he keeps voting the right way, regardless of what letter he has, you know?
That's true. Wow, for sure. And last year, last November, Harry Reid changed the rules. I guess they used some kind of a procedural somersault to change the rules.
Right.
But now there's only a 51-vote majority necessary to confirm judicial nominees or nominees such as the Attorney General position. Only 51.
That's right.
He did away with the nuclear option. Yeah. So he did away with the judicial filibuster. Give us a little bit of background on what the judicial filibuster was and when it started and just some background on that.
Sure. Well, the judicial filibuster, kind of the background, Senate has a long, long history of this thing called the filibuster. And really what the filibuster is if we're on the Senate floor and we're talking about some item, let's just say it's a nomination, we're talking about confirming Joe Smith to a court. At some point, the leader of the Senate will say, okay, we've talked about this a long time, folks. Let's bring this to a vote, okay? Well, in order to do that, the majority has to have 60 votes to cut off debate, end debate, and say, okay, we're finished talking about it. Let's vote. So what that means is that 41 senators can stop someone from ever coming up for a vote if they just say, no, we're not going to stop talking. We'd like to continue to debate and talk about this nominee. And so, that's what's called a filibuster.
Okay, so they would have to get 60 votes to stop debate and then move forward to the actual vote.
That's right. Okay. That's right. And so in the past, there were 45 Republicans in the Senate, and if 41 of them said, no, we don't want to move forward on this nomination, then there would never be a vote. And so they could prevent a vote from coming up. And that had happened in a few instances, not a lot, but in a few. I wish it had been a lot, Diane, because we could have stopped some other bad folks. But that had happened some, and it had been used well and used to stop some really radical nominees. And the president also was losing some cases at the D.C. Circuit Court. And so he wanted to stack that court in his advantage because they're the court that hears a lot of these cases and appeals about the president's abuse of executive power, which is what he's getting ready to do on immigration, right? Abuse his executive power.
Oh, yeah.
So he stacked that court with some of his folks and was in the process of trying to get them confirmed. And it was very clear that Republicans were going to block all three of those nominees. Mm-hmm. They had the votes. They had 41 votes to do it.
Yeah.
And so that's when Harry Reid said, well, we're going to change the rule, which had never been done in the history of the United States. He changed the rule during the session from 60 votes down to 51.
Yeah, because aren't the rules usually made at the beginning of the legislative
that's
session,
right.
not in the middle?
That's
okay.
right. Mm-hmm, that's right. And so he literally broke the rules in order to change them.
But hey, who cares?
But it's,
I mean,
yeah, it's the
that's
type
the
of thing
idea.
That,
And so is there something that the horse just quickly, is there something the Republicans could have done after Harry Reid broke the rules?
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, a court would not hear that case because you're talking, courts are not going to get involved in another branch's internal rules.
Okay.
Now, if you've got a case about whether, you know, obviously if a statute that Congress passes violates the Constitution, the court will hear that all day long. But when it comes to internal rules of how the Senate operates, courts just won't hear those cases.
Yeah, they figure they're an independent body that they can make their own rules and break their own rules.
Exactly. And they did.
Yeah, they sure did.
They did.
So wasn't it back in 2003 where the Democrats themselves created the filibuster or the judicial filibuster?
You bring up a great point, Diane, which is that although a filibuster could be used, it had been used back in, I guess it was the 60s when Abe Fortas was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court, but that was an isolated incident and it was never used since, especially had never been used on anything other than a Supreme Court appointment until, I think it was Estrada, Miguel Estrada.
Okay.
And the Democrats filibustered Estrada and defeated him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's when Democrats were opposing President Bush's nominees, and so the filibuster became a tool that had not been used except for that one isolated incident.
Mm-hmm.
But then it became used commonly by the Democrats during the Bush
absolutely.
Years.
And in fact, was it 2005, the Republicans tried to do away with that, with the judicial filibuster?
Well, no, good point. It was discussed at the time that Republicans were considering changing the rule because they had the majority of the Senate, and President Bush was in the White House, and the majority of Republicans in the Senate couldn't get the votes to confirm Bush's nominees. And so they thought about pulling the nuclear option, which is what Harry Reid did. But they didn't. They decided, no, we're not going to do that. That is
wasn't that the Gang of 14?
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Exactly. That's where the Gang of 14 came in, and they made a deal, and they said, okay, we're not going to use the nuclear option, but we're only going to oppose nominees if they are, quote, controversial. Well, you know, what's controversial to me is different.
That's for sure. It all depends. That's a matter of how you define the word controversial.
Exactly. So they kind of just kicked it down the road. The Republicans never pulled the nuclear option. The Democrats have, and the reason it's called the nuclear option is because everybody thought, you know, once you go nuclear, everybody goes nuclear, and you'll never go back to having a filibuster. And I think that's true.
Yeah.
And I certainly at this point hope it's true.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, we're in the same situation now. We have the Republicans as of this coming January, they will be in the majority again. So they should not. I mean, there's been talk that they may reinstitute the judicial filibuster, which would require the 60 votes to end debate and go to the actual vote. That's not a good idea, right?
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Now, And I want to talk about why it's not a good idea. But first, it actually would potentially, and I say potentially, benefit Republicans for the next 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And here's why. Because to stop a nominee, you can stop a nominee with 41 votes.
Right.
And so it's possible if the president's nominating people that we don't like, Republicans may have 54 votes in the Senate. So we could literally lose 13 liberal Republicans and still stop a nominee.
Mm-hmm.
The other part of that is that if Republicans are in charge of the Judiciary Committee, where we can stop a nominee, and Republicans are in charge of the leadership of the Senate, then they can refuse to schedule votes. And there are a lot of other things that can be done by the leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't get our leadership to agree to stop a nominee, it's not very realistic that we could get 41 votes.
Right, right.
To stop a nominee, right? I mean, if we can't even get McConnell and some other folks, then we're kind of in a bad spot
not
anyway.
Crick,
but nevertheless, from a numbers perspective, it could help Republicans in the short term to restore the filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
But when it really matters is if there's a Republican president in the White House 2 years from now, and if Republicans are in charge of the Senate, suppose Ginsburg retires from the Supreme Court and there's a vacancy and a Republican president nominates someone. Do we really want to have to get six Democrats to vote with Republicans to get that person confirmed?
Yeah.
Or would we rather be able to say, no, all we need is 51 votes, which means we can even lose Susan Collins and two other liberal Republicans and still get a nominee confirmed and not need one Democrat to support them?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So even though it may be beneficial in the short term, in the long term, if we get a Republican president sworn in 2017, then that would be... it'd be better to leave things as they are now in the Senate when it comes to confirmations, and the judicial filibuster is not a good idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And, and what it would amount to, Diane, is if we go and change the rule back, some senators think, well, they're just in love with the filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
It's been there for so long, and, you know, this is great tradition, and we need to restore it and be poetic, you know.
Yeah.
It's a joke because the Democrats will just laugh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because what it means is, you know, it's kind of like playing a football game where the Democrats have 15 players on the field and we have 11.
Yeah.
And we're sitting here going, no, we are traditionalists. We're going to act with integrity. We're going to play with 11, even though the other side's playing with 15.
That's
a joke.
That's
you're going to lose.
For sure, for sure.
And we're talking about America. We're talking about our country. We're talking about the future of the judiciary.
Oh, yeah.
It's way too important to be dumb and think we're going to play with 11 against 15. And
that's
what it would amount to.
For sure. Especially with the judiciary becoming so powerful, becoming so unconstitutionally powerful. Let's put it like that. And so what can we do to get the message across that we believe the Republicans should maintain the status quo, not reinstitute the judicial filibuster?
Yeah, I think it's very important that Senator Pat Toomey hear from your people to say, do not reinstitute the filibuster.
Okay.
And I don't know where Senator Toomey stands on this issue, and so I don't mean to insinuate that he's not on
but it's
my
always
side
good to,
or your
yeah, but
side.
It's always, but it's always good to hear from constituents.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, do it respectfully, but at the same time, be very forceful, because there are some folks that I do, some senators that I do like that vote the right way a number of times, but they tend to think that they want to restore the filibuster. Well, with all due respect, I just think that's foolish.
Yeah. Former Senator Jim DeMint calls it the zombie session, I believe is the term he uses.
That's right.
Because you have all these unelected people coming back to Washington, D.C., walking like a zombie to just rubber stamp. How can folks contact you, your organization?
Yeah, thank you. Our website is, it's a long one, but it's our name, judicialactiongroup.com.
Okay,
you can search it on Google or just type it in judicialactiongroup.com.
Okay. And then there's email and all that kind of stuff and all sorts of neat information on the website.
That's right.
So
that's
I do encourage your listeners to go to judicialactiongroup.com and check that out, especially with this lame duck session and all that's going to take place. Thanks, Philip, for being with us. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, Diane. Thank you, and God bless you.
God bless you, too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You have been listening to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. If you would like to get involved in the efforts to defend traditional values in Pennsylvania, please contact the AFAFPA by writing to Post Office Box 1048, Franklin, Pennsylvania, 16323, or by visiting their website at www.afafpa.org.